This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we have Max Blumenthal, the award-winning journalist, talking about the attack on international humanitarian law under the rubric Lawfare.
It's getting rougher and rougher for Israel to defend itself. They're aggressively attacking anyone who criticizes their actions. They call it lawfare.
We're proud to celebrate a critical victory against the racist, anti-Arab forces in the city of New York.
You all remember Debbie Almentazer. She was supposed to be the principal at the Khalil Gibran School. Well, she wasn't made the principal, and now the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, has found that the city discriminated against her.
Stay with us.
We have award-winning journalist and best-selling author Max Blumenthal to speak with us on the Lawfare Project. The Lawfare Project, in essence, is an attack on international law by the Israeli government and its allies here in the United States. The attack on international law comes after the attack on Gaza. Instead of facing up to the crimes it committed there, the Israeli government and its spokespeople here in the United States, going by the name of the Lawfare Project, are attacking the law used to criticize Israel's deliberate attack on Palestinian civilians and their infrastructure. Max Blumenthal has written Inside the Lawfare Project, Netanyahu's attack on human rights NGOs hits the States. And he calls the Lawfare Project event recently held at the New York County Lawyers Association an anti-Goldstone report, anti-human rights bashing. Our own Michael Ratner and the Center for Constitutional Rights was also a target of the Lawfare Project. To talk more about this, journalist Max Blumenthal joins us. Max, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be here.
Max, you had the pleasure of attending the Lawfare conference 2 weeks ago. Tell us, what's Lawfare and what were you doing there?
Oh, what a pleasure it was to be in a room full of neocons for 2 hours, which seemed like an eternity. Lawfare is a new, neocon neologism for what they consider to be acts of legal warfare against the state of Israel, because the state of Israel wants to violate international law in the way it conducts war and in the way it maintains its occupation of the Palestinians. And so this conference was convened at the New York Lawyers Association with the dean of the Columbia University Law School presiding over it, and politicians, neoconservative think tank heads, and Israeli high officials convening basically to bash the Goldstone Report, which they consider to be the zenith of lawfare against the state of Israel, and to bash the human rights groups which contributed data and reporting to the Goldstone Report, which, in the Goldstone Report, for those who don't know, accused Hamas and Israel of war crimes in Israel's assault on the Gaza Strip in late 2008 and early 2009. And it's made life pretty difficult for Israeli officials, from Tzipi Livni to Ehud Olmert, in traveling around the world, because they may face arrest warrants.
We're speaking with Max Blumenthal, and he has some completely brilliant pieces, and particularly one on the Lawfare Conference on a website called MondoWeiss.com. Is that right, Max?
Yeah, no, you can find it at my blog as well, MaxBlumenthal.com.
Well, it's been great reporting. And Max talked about lawfare as a concept of really trying to justify Israel's violations of international humanitarian law and international law in general. I won't say where it originally goes. Some of its origins of lawfare was when it was used, I think, by the British to delegitimize the local law systems in countries that were their colonies many, many years ago. Right. But in its recent manifestation, before it was used around the Israel stuff, it was used against the Center for Constitutional Rights and me and other Guantanamo lawyers, saying that by representing the people at Guantanamo, we were basically practicing lawfare, which means using law as a means of conducting foreign policy, more or less, and having little to do with the law, which is, of course, complete BS. I mean, that's just we were representing individuals who were jailed. And now it's been moved, as you pointed out, heavily into lawfare as a means of trying to delegitimize people who are criticizing Israel from a legal point of view and make those people appear that they're doing it for political reasons.
And we're also seeing it used by Liz Cheney and people out of her newfangled neocon shop to attack the so-called Al-Qaeda lawyers, who are people in the Justice Department who defended Guantanamo clients, as any lawyer should do, and to paint them as an un-American fifth column. And actually, Liz Cheney is funded by Mel Sembler, who is a big funder of lots of projects in Israel, including settlement-related projects. And he has an interest in getting international law out of the way because he ran a center for wayward and troubled children in Mexico, where there was massive abuse of these children, where massive abuse of children took place. And he ran it in Mexico because he wanted to skirt rules on how children can be on corporal punishment of children. So this is really a sick operation to the core. And the further you look, and the more below the surface you look, the more depraved it gets.
Max, let's get back to the lawfare with respect to the attack of the Israeli government and its allies here in the United States on the Goldstone Report. What specifically in the Goldstone Report do they deny or ignore? What's bothering them about the Goldstone Report?
Well, the Goldstone Report they consider to be an act of delegitimization against the state of Israel. That's a word we're hearing increasingly. I actually would consider Israel's actions to be an acts of delegitimization because they're going further and further outside the scope of international law with what they're doing in the Gaza Strip. And it's pretty well known to anyone who was there, who visited there afterwards, any of the human rights groups, that there were deliberate attacks on civilian targets, including the American University there, or the home of the Simuni family. 41 members of the same family were killed. And so what Israel wants to do is, instead of actually having to deny these charges in a public forum, to attack Judge Goldstone as an anti-Semite, even though he's a Jewish Zionist, to attack the Goldstone Report as an act of warfare, and to basically dismiss the whole thing. And so this project that we saw, this meeting that we saw in New York, there are some PR firms that were heavily involved with the project, like 5WPR, which used to represent Birthright Israel, is run by a guy named Ron Tarosian, who has been involved in settler attacks on Palestinians when he lived in Israel, and he boasted of it, and is a spokesman for Hebron, has been a spokesman for the Hebron Fund, which funds the radical settlers in Hebron. They're now carrying out PR for the Lawfare Project. It really reveals, and they're being funded through the law firm of Pat Robertson, the American Center for Law and Justice, which is run by Jay Sekulow, Pat Robertson's longtime legal counsel. He gets millions and millions in donations from his right-wing evangelical flock. And so this is really an effort, I think, of public diplomacy by the Israeli government, funded by right-wing Jewish and Christian Zionist interests, an act of hasbara, which is Hebrew for public diplomacy. I don't know what actions they're going to take, but Israel's response to any effort to hold it accountable for the crimes that it's been committing, according to international law, has been hasbara, hasbara, and hasbara, just more and more propaganda. And this is just one more facet of that.
We're seeing a moment, I think this Lawfare Project illustrates it, of a major effort by the Zionist community, not just the Zionist, but the right-wing Zionist community, to just try and demolish any criticism of Israel, legal or otherwise. And when I first got the flyer, the Lawfare Project, and it said, at the bottom it had going to be at the Bar Association, and then it had this other group you just mentioned, the American, what was the name of it?
American Center for Law and Justice.
Right, and of course, I looked up them right away, and of course, they have a long screed against the Goldstone Report on their website, and then one of our people looked up the Lawfare Project, and it doesn't say anything about this on the flyer, but that's founded by the President's
Conference of Jewish American Presidents, which is
major organizations. Right?
Major organizations, which is Alan Solow and another extreme right wing American Zionist figure, and they handled all the the initial preparation for it. The new spokesperson for the Lawfare Project is Brooke Goldstein, and she formerly headed a group called the Children's Rights International, which has nothing to do with children's rights at all. It merely has to do with the demonization of Palestinians and the accusation that they're abusing their children by supposedly indoctrinating them and inciting them to become terrorists. And I brought a bunch of some material here to show you guys. One of them is put out by a group called the NGO Monitor, which is headed by Gerald Steinberg, who is a notorious figure in Israel for his campaign to defund, delegitimize, and demonize all Israeli human rights groups. And by the way, human rights has just a different connotation in Israel. Tel Aviv had its first human rights march, or Israel had its first human rights march in its history this year. So it's not exactly this revered concept. Civil rights is sort of looked down upon by mainstream Israeli society. So these human rights groups like B'Tselem are extremely marginalized and vulnerable. And we recently saw another campaign on a parallel track by a right-wing student group called Im Tirtzu, headed by a settler who is trying to rebrand himself as a mainstream figure to demonize the head of the New Israel Fund, which is one of the few democratic elements in Israeli society, headed by Naomi Hazan, who's a former Knesset member, sort of a liberal left Zionist figure. And they were accused of funding 92% of the organizations which contributed to the Goldstone Report, which contributed data and reporting to the Goldstone Report, through ads that Im Tirtzu put up around Israel depicting Naomi Hazan with a horn on her head, a classic anti-Semitic caricature. Hazan was immediately fired by the Jerusalem Post. She was a columnist there. An Australian Zionist group refused to host her at a speech, and she's been marginalized ever since. Human rights workers who are friends of mine in Israel are telling me that they're finding graffiti outside their homes that says price tag, which is settler slang for you will be assassinated if you continue what you're doing. There has to be a price tag for your activity. This has been reported by Yediot Aronoth, one of the leading Israeli newspapers. So I'm not just making this up. And this is all being drummed up by Gerald Steinberg and NGO Monitor by accusing these human rights groups in their contribution to the Goldstone Report of being a traitorous fifth column. And that was the rhetoric we heard at the Lawfare Project at the New York Lawyers Association. But in addition to these Israelis and Palestinian human rights workers being singled out, you, Michael, were singled out as a traitor to the United States of America openly, and you are in this NGO Monitor blacklist put together by NGO Monitor's legal advisor, Ann Hertzberg, and you are accused of NGO Lawfare. You and Human Rights Watch, that anti-Semitic group, Human Rights Watch.
Michael, so, defend yourself here.
No, I'm more interested in, I'm very interested in what went on at the conference, partly, of course, about me and the other organizations, but about what it was like in there. I remember your article opens with this ornate room with big chandeliers, and then you're sitting with a panel that's completely, not just panels, but every speaker is one-sided. Is that right? Is there anybody who defended Goldstone?
Well, as I said, David Schizer, I love that last
Schizer,
name.
I think
Schizer
is his name.
Sorry, I mispronounce it. It might be a Freudian slip. I don't know if anyone knows German, but I was amazed by his speech because he just immediately, took to the podium, the dean of the Columbia Law School, and began laying into Goldstone, but in slightly less strident terms than the other speakers. We heard David Mattis, who is a Canadian lawyer who's been ironically trying to take on the Chinese government over the issue of organ harvesting and invoking international law against them and saying that former Chinese Premier Zhang should be brought before the Hague for what he's been doing. But then when he speaks of the Goldstone Report, because he's also the legal counsel for B'nai B'rith Canada, he compares what Goldstone and what you're doing, Michael, and what other nice Jewish boys are doing to anti-Semitic gangs. He said this is equivalent to anti-Semitic gangs beating up Jews in the street. Jeremy Rabkin, who's a professor at George Mason University, an outspoken neoconservative and ally of the Bush administration, invoked the Holocaust and the Jewish people's inherent right to self-defense in fighting the Goldstone Report. So we're getting a lot of accusations of anti-Semitism. Rabkin went on to say that those who were involved in contributing to the Goldstone Report, echoing what we're hearing from NGO Monitor, were anti-American and anti-Israel, traitors.
What they want, it seems to me, certainly in my case and maybe the center's case, they want an exemption for Israel. They want an exemption for Israel from violating international law.
Yeah.
Because if I look at the career of the center or my own, I've gone after, human rights violators in every country in the world, all of Central America, Haiti, all over the world. And so we do a little bit of work about human rights violations in Gaza or the West Bank. And all of a sudden, I'm an enemy of the United States.
Yeah.
I'm anti-Semitic. But when I'm doing work on Haiti or El Salvador or Nicaragua or wherever else in the world, then it's fine. But Israel somehow believes that it's exempt from the laws that govern our civilization.
Well, I think that you and I can say this. There was something that most of these speakers had in common, which is that they're conservative Jews, not conservative in the denominational sense, but conservative in a political sense. And they are Jewish exceptionalists who believe that because Israel supposedly claims to speak on behalf of the Jewish people, they have a right to act outside the scope of international law. David Mattis, the lawyer who I mentioned earlier, actually said, because international law is the legacy of the Holocaust, it should always side with Israel. And so they're seeking emotional justifications and subtle ethnic justifications for their defense of Israel without debating the Goldstone Report or Israel's actions on the merits. I brought actually the most direct attack on the Goldstone Report here from the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs, which is headed by Ambassador Dori Gold, who is a speaker there, former Ambassador Dori Gold. And Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs is one of the premier groups in Israel concerned with Hasbara, with public diplomacy, or what I would consider propaganda. And this report is actually a summation of the case that Gold presented in his debate with Judge Richard Goldstone at Brandeis. And it begins by accusing—
Dori Gold debated Judge Goldstone at Brandeis, yes.
Right, in late 2009.
Right.
And it begins by accusing Judge Goldstone of maligning Israeli society, which is, I think, incredibly revealing because when what it reveals is the sense that what the Israeli army did in Gaza was a reflection of the essential character of Israeli society, and to attack it attacks Israel and attacks the Jewish people in general, who Israel claims to speak on behalf of. I think that's incredibly revealing, and it's incredibly dangerous. I think it puts Jews throughout the world in danger when they claim that the Gaza assault, which killed over 700 civilians, is somehow a reflection of the Jewish ethos. And I would just, reject and dispute that.
I think that's a strong point. I think one of the keys for me and for Jewish Americans, for Jews everywhere, is to say what Israel is doing is wrong, that it has to be held accountable, because otherwise you're going to engender anti-Semitism by actually supporting a country that believes it can, with impunity, violate international law.
And we saw one day before Biden's arrival, Vice President Biden's arrival, and after George Mitchell had arrived, Benjamin Netanyahu appear in a surprise appearance with Pastor John Hagee, the anti-Semitic Christian Zionist preacher from Texas who held a huge rally in Jerusalem against the settlement freeze that the Obama administration had called for and in favor of the expansion of settlements. And by the way, Hagee is a big funder of this right-wing student group attacking human rights groups in Israel called Im Tirtzu. And when Netanyahu appeared, the first thing he said to this audience of Christian Zionists who are yearning for the apocalypse is, "We salute you and the Jewish people salute you." What right does Benjamin Netanyahu have to speak on behalf of Jewish people to an audience like that, to a figure like Hagee, who has said that the Holocaust was a divinely ordained phenomenon designed to bring about biblical prophecy? Netanyahu has taken this right for himself, and because he hasn't been challenged sufficiently by the American Jewish community, and so it's really time to challenge Israel's right to speak on behalf of Jewish people.
Were there questions at the Lawfare conference, or was just speaking to the audience?
The audience was so thoroughly populated by card-carrying neocons that I really didn't hear any. And again, I was only there towards the end of the day. I didn't hear any adversarial questions or critical questions. Catherine Franke, who's a professor of law at Columbia Law School, actually politely confronted the dean, Schizer, he was leaving and said, why weren't there any speakers who could present an alternative viewpoint? And he said, well, we invited a few, but they just couldn't make it. You know, it's sort of like the dog ate my homework. And then he scurried away as fast as he could. He refused an interview with me and refused all interviews and delegated this person, Brooke Goldstein, who is sort of an Israel lobbyist, to handle the cameras through this PR group paid for by Pat Robertson's lawyer. So that was really revealing to me. This is just a Hasbara effort, and it's gone because it's gone unchallenged, you see establishment figures taking the lead. We also saw Robert Morgenthau kind of put his name on the flyer,
yeah, that
too.
That surprised me. Was Morgenthau there?
I didn't see him. I think he might have just been wheeled in for a second.
You know, Max and Michael, I'm a member of the New York County Lawyers Association. The building is two doors away from my office on Vesey Street. And I was proud to join the organization. I've been a member for 25 years. And one of the things that people like about it was set up as an alternative to the Association of the Bar, the city of New York, which would not accept black lawyers, way back when. And this was a liberal organization that over the years has done some good stuff. And so they got the cover of this organization.
Right.
For their conference,
another
irony.
You know how they got the cover of it? Do you know, Max? This is interesting.
I'd like to hear.
Well, these kind of conferences are put on, obviously, by the two main sponsors, which was the Lawfare Project and this Christian Zionist group called
American Center for Law and Justice.
So those are the two that are on the flyer. But it's also set up by the bar committee, particularly bar committee at that bar association. And that bar committee is headed by John Bolton's lawyer.
Oh.
As it happens. John Bolton was one of the speakers.
Yeah, right.
Who's, of course, a right-wing neocon.
What did he say, to blow up the top seven stories of the UN or something?
Right.
He said if you took them all off, it wouldn't hurt the UN.
And the bar committee is headed by his personal lawyer or his former personal lawyer. It was basically, as you said, Hasbara, or the assault now on anyone who dissents on the issue of Israel, Gaza, or the West Bank. And it's going on across the board right now. This is one major example. But it's, as you said, it's going on everywhere.
Yeah, it shows what we're up against. And
money we're up against, the efforts we're up against.
And just the image of it is intended to intimidate those who want to speak out, especially in the Jewish community, but haven't done so yet. Especially people who have something to, unlike me, who is a freelance journalist and lives in a one-bedroom apartment and has really no family, people who have something to lose, people who have jobs to lose, people who have faculty positions to lose, people who have donations to lose. This is an effort to intimidate them.
Yeah, no, it's been going on for a long time. I think my view is they're getting less successful.
Yeah.
Not because we're so powerful, but because Israel has gone so far overboard in Gaza and the West Bank that there's actually some reaction in the American community.
Yeah. I think that there's a split in the American Jewish community because the right-wing Israeli government is distasteful to a lot of American Jewish liberals. And you're seeing a real change going on now. I think you're also seeing some of the truth come out about what Israel does, and that alienates the Arab countries. And that leads me to a question I want to ask both of you about General Petraeus, who's been in the news lately, talking about Israel is undermining our effort to work with our other allies in the Middle East. What did you make of that?
Well, it's something that others have been saying for a long time who didn't quite have the standing or credibility of David Petraeus among a mainstream American audience. People like Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, who were demonized as anti-Semites immediately, and their German names were highlighted by certain reporters. after making this very point in their book, The Israel Lobby, Lawrence Wright made this point in The Looming Tower, his book about the genesis of al-Qaeda and the 9/11 attacks, that bin Laden was enormously influenced and benefited from the resentment around the United States' unwavering commitment to delivering whatever weapons Israel wanted each year, and is along with $3 billion in aid, which is more aid than all African countries receive combined. So there is a linkage here, and we're seeing mainstream Republican figures like Petraeus actually make the linkage between Israel, Islamic terrorism, and the danger that U.S. troops face in Iraq and Afghanistan as a result of the resentment fanned by this lopsided and biased relationship towards Israel. And
I think this was to me a huge story, in fact. I agree.
It's a bombshell.
It's right. It's been said, as you said, by Mearsheimer and Walt, and by almost anybody who has any sense would say this is an issue for Muslim people in the world. It's an issue for Arab people in the world. We've got to do something about Israel and Palestine. But the fact that General Petraeus apparently gave a presentation, a slideshow that had Admiral Mullen, the, I guess, head of the chief, chief of staff, apparently his mouth dropped because this is General Petraeus saying, I want to, he actually said, I want to make, as part of my central command, which includes Israel, I want to include Gaza and the West Bank as part of my central command.
Right.
And he's made the point you're making that Arab countries think we're weak on Israel. They're not going to trust us. This can lead to more deaths of my soldiers, it went on to say. I mean, it's, as you said, it's a bombshell.
And CENTCOM relies heavily on its relationships with Arab countries, their intelligence services, and their military. And the military is still a professional organization, unlike Israel's army, which has been politicized and deprofessionalized through the occupation, and I would argue actually weakened. And we saw what they did to McCarthy. We're facing a McCarthyite campaign right now that the Israel lobby is waging. And so the military is actually against people like you, against against anyone who tries to present a realistic foreign policy perspective. So the military, I think, is emerging as a counterweight to the Israel lobby. And this is what led to this briefing. Biden, I think, was in on this briefing. And this is what led him to tell Netanyahu directly, you are putting our troops in danger.
Right. When Biden said that, that's extraordinary.
And that's even more extraordinary because Biden was the biggest tool of AIPAC when he was in the Senate. I remember him attacking people for blaming Israel when Israel turned half of Lebanon into rubble in 2006.
We haven't seen anything like this in 9 years. After 9/11, Bush said they hate us for our freedom. And the only person to attempt to speak out was Susan Sontag, and she said, what freedom? You know what Osama bin Laden said. He said, they hate us because we're supporting Israel, and we've got bases in Saudi Arabia, and we starved the Iraqi children. He said that. That's why they blew us up, but they never allowed that discussion. And now it's coming around the corner out of the U.S. Army. It's amazing.
So, Max, we're getting close to the end of our time on this interview, but you know, we're obviously at an amazing moment. I think even you've covered this issue for a number of years, but it seems to me we're in a shift of some sort. I'm interested in your perceptions of what you see happening next.
Yeah.
How serious is this, quote, breach with Israel on settlements and other issues? How serious are we to take what Petraeus said? What do you see in the, unfolding in the next while?
I know that we sort of sound hopeful on this show, but I think this is a time for deep, deep concern. If you see what's happening around the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem and throughout Israel, there was rioting in the West Bank. For the past few months or past few years, there's been a nonviolent protest movement emerging in the West Bank that I've taken part in, that you've taken part in, that the world is beginning to recognize as legitimate. You know, people have wondered, where's the Palestinian Gandhi? Well, he's either in Israeli prisons or he's in places like Nilin or Bilin, these Palestinian villages protesting the wall nonviolently. And Israel, through its Shin Bet secret police under the purview of Yuval Diskin, who said that the biggest threat to us is nonviolent resistance, is implementing a push strategy to push the Palestinians into violence and terrorism. Then they can say, Obama sent Biden here, they pressured us, and look what we got, more Palestinian terrorism. Then they're going to go through groups like the Lawfare Project, through AIPAC, and their troops in the U.S., their Quislings in the U.S., and say there is no linkage here. You guys were wrong, and it's going to be disastrous for those who lined up behind this nonviolent popular protest movement and the BDS movement.
BDS being the
effort to pressure through grassroots measures for a boycott and sanctioning of Israel and Israeli companies until it complies with international law. And so I think this is a moment for deep concern, and that people should be monitoring closely what's happening on the ground and documenting the fact that there is this strategy to push the Palestinians and provoke them into acts of violence.
I mean, it's not the answer I expected, but it's a really important answer.
Well, I think that's what's going to color our discussion in the coming year.
I think it's a really important answer, and I agree with that. I mean, as you said, I've been part of those nonviolent movements. It was actually the most, partly from I'm going to be looking at it from a distance, is the most important movement that's been happening in the occupied territories. And Israel will do anything it can to try and make it perceived as a violent movement.
So what this is really an effort to demonize and actually delegitimize the Palestinian struggle forever and delegitimize anyone who dares to ally themselves with the nonviolent aspect of it, including in Israel. And I think those friends of mine in Israel who have put themselves on the line for it are in physical danger right now.
Max Blumenthal, let me ask you a personal question, if I might. You're a person from a Jewish background. How did you get involved in support of the Palestinians?
This is an issue that was not really discussed in my home. By the way, I'm also like the son of, I think, people who are prominent in public life in the U.S. My father was a White House advisor. My mother worked in the White House. My father was in the Washington Press Corps. As a Jew growing up in Washington, D.C., going to a liberal synagogue, you're expected to be sort of a liberal Zionist, and you don't really need to discuss it or explore the issue very much. My synagogue draped the UN flag in a black shroud because of the Zionism is racism resolution, and that was never really debated. I would never say that my parents were ever hard Zionists or pushed me in any way, but as a Jew in growing up after the 70s, when the Jewish community became heavily politicized around the issue of Israel and the Holocaust, Zionism just calls on you. And I was offered a free trip to go to Israel under the Birthright Israel program. And I said, I like free trips, so I'm going to take it. And when I came back, I was much more politicized. When I returned to the U.S. right before the Second Intifada heated up, right before Jenin, and I began exploring the issue carefully and reading voraciously, I wanted to be a liberal Zionist. I wanted to be still palatable and fit within the Jewish community's supposedly big tent, which is actually only big enough to fit Jeffrey Goldberg. Who is the writer for The Atlantic, who's, I think, probably one of the most important distorted voices on Israel and blogs at The Atlantic and is actually a former Israeli prison guard, which tells you where the discussion is, and is a very large individual. So that which gives the perception of a big tent. But I watched what happened in Jenin, what Israel did in Jenin, and I couldn't stand in a comfortable liberal Zionist position, and I began exploring the issue more and more. I watched what they did in Lebanon, and I couldn't say that I was a Zionist anymore, and I needed to explore this issue from a different perspective. After Gaza, that was just really it for me and a lot of people, and I went over there for an extended period to see what was going on the ground. I went throughout the West Bank, throughout Israel, and what I found in Israel was particularly disturbing. Just talking to people my age, I'm 32, or just slightly younger than me, who are professionals, nice, urbane, cosmopolitan people at the bar, at a club, in the park. We're having a nice discussion, and then suddenly the conversation veers into the conflict, and the things that came out of their mouth about the Palestinians reminded me of the things that I would see in stock footage of people in the Jim Crow South discussing African Americans, and watching people being thrown off Tel Aviv city buses for speaking Arabic and being detained and even violently harassed told me that Israel is in the grip of a mass psychosis, and we see this over and over in polls of the Israeli public, especially polls conducted by Daniel Bartal, who is a Tel Aviv University political psychologist and researcher, who's done the only comprehensive polling on Israeli attitudes since Gaza. His most recent poll showed that vast majority of Israeli high school students, 58% of Jewish Israeli high school students, believe that Arab citizens of Israel should be stripped of their rights, should not be allowed to be elected to Knesset or to vote. So they favor apartheid. And 85% of high school students who are Jewish Israelis who identify themselves as religious nationalists or ally with the settler movement are in favor of apartheid. So Avigdor Lieberman, an open fascist, was the leading vote getter among high school students because Israel has national high school elections that are just symbolic in nature.
And he's currently the foreign minister.
He's currently the foreign minister, and he's supposed to be a pariah. But among the young generation, here, what we see is we see increasingly progressive trends among the youth in the United States. But among youth in Israel, we're seeing a trend increasingly towards the favoring of apartheid, and I think that's really troubling. And I'm hoping to go back and just go deeper into what's leading to that. Why what's going on in the education ministry in Israel? What's going on in the education system? And how does the army play into this? Because this is a society that mandates universal conscription. And according to Daniel Bartal, the researcher who I mentioned and who I interviewed, Israel is not, you have a lot of countries in Europe that are, or countries like Costa Rica that are states without an army, but Israel's an army without a state. And so there's really no way for young people, unless they become refuseniks, to avoid the heavy indoctrination and peer pressure that they face through the army, through senior officers and veterans of battles like Gaza and Lebanon.
So now, Max, give us your website again where you can read your articles. These are, I just want to tell people, these are just great articles. Max is a fabulous writer. His one on lawfare I just loved reading. But tell us where people can go.
It's maxblumenthal.com. At some point in the near future, I should be reporting from the Holy Land, so keep following me.
You should.
Inshallah, Max Blumenthal.
Blumenthal is B-L-U-M-E-N-T-H-A-L. Okay, Max, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
This is Eli Smith from the Dustbusters, and you're listening to Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.
Occasionally we get some very good news. This is one of those occasions. Last week, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, also known as the EEOC, found that the Department of Education, known as the DOE, discriminated against interim principal Debbie Almentazer in 2007 when they forced her to resign as principal of the Cahil Gibran International Academy. We brought you information on Debbie's case when it happened in 2007, and we're pleased now that she's had a victory in front of the EEOC. The Cahil Gibran School was envisioned to provide knowledge and understanding of Arab language and culture. The controversy began way before its doors even opened. Almentazer was forced to resign after she was quoted in the New York Post explaining that the word intifada literally means shaking off in Arabic. This was in reference to a controversy stirring over a T-shirt that read, quote, Intifada, New York City, created and worn by a group called Arab Women Active in the Arts and Media. Almentazer came under severe criticism for not denouncing the T-shirt. The EEOC ruling calls on the Department of Education to reach a, quote, just resolution, as well as meet Almentazer's demand of a reinstatement, back pay, damages, and legal costs. Almentazer's attorney, Alan Levine, recently told reporters that DOE succumbed to the hatred that she and the school were designed to oppose. And that, frankly, was a missed opportunity by New York City government. Today, we're happy to have with us the winning attorney, Alan Levine, on the phone, and Mona Eldery, who is the co-founder of Arab Women Active in the Arts.
Attorney Alan Levine, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you.
Alan, it was just a delight for all of us to wake up in the morning, open the paper, and see that we got a big victory for a change. Tell us what was at stake and what happened.
Well, we filed the better part of a year ago a claim with the EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, federal agency charged with investigating claims of employment discrimination. And the charge said that Debbie Almentasser had been the victim of discrimination based upon her being an Arab and a practicing Muslim. We did not claim that people at Department of Education, her employer, were necessarily biased because, after all, they had hired her in the first place knowing that she was an Arab and a Muslim, but rather that they had capitulated to mob pressure, to community prejudice, when the firestorm erupted after the New York Post article in August of 2007. That was an article in which she was quoted as saying, defining the word intifada, after which she was roundly criticized by community organizations and public officials alleged to be associated with or defending violence in the Middle East. Her remarks about the intifada were as neutral and substantial as one could have imagined. Nevertheless, this firestorm broke out, and in response, instead of the DOE saying, hey, that's absurd to connect her to violence, she's dedicated her life to nonviolence, to intergroup reconciliation, instead of quelling the fire as simply as they could have with such a statement, they let it play itself out over a couple of days. The firestorm grew. Randy Weingarten of the UFT poured gasoline on the flames by questioning her qualifications for the position. Eventually, eventually a day or two later, she was called in first by the head of an organization called New Visions, which had helped establish the school, to say that she had to resign. She demanded to speak to the chancellor. He was away. They sent the deputy mayor, Dennis Walcott, to meet with her. He told her that if she didn't resign, they would close the school, and so she submitted her resignation.
Now, this school was the Khalil Gibran. It was supposed to be an Arabic-speaking school, is that right?
It was a dual-language school, the Khalil Gibran International Academy. Debbie had been selected first by New Visions, endorsed by the Department of Education and the Arab American community, because of her long record both as an educator and as an active member of the Arab American community. She was out of central casting for the position. She couldn't have been more perfect for it. And the DOE knew about that record. It's why they had selected her. It's what they could have said. But instead, they just capitulated, and that's what the EEOC found, that by capitulating to community prejudice, if the DOE itself had become a discriminator, that is, was guilty of unlawful discrimination.
Alan, we're sitting here in the studio with Mona, and I know you referred to the New York Post interview, and I just want to go back and give a bit of background on that. Mona, you had some role in this in some way.
Right. The T-shirts that Debbie was questioned about in the New York Post interview were produced by AWAM, Arab Women Active in the Arts and Media. And of course, Debbie had nothing to do with the T-shirts, and we had very little or nothing to do with Debbie, but somehow she was blamed for them, associated with them, asked about them. So first of all, the Department of Education required, absolutely positively required her to do this interview with the Post, even though she didn't want to. Why didn't she want to? Because the Post is one of the most racist newspapers in the city. It's actually been boycotted on several occasions by the Arab and Muslim communities in New York, right? But they forced her to do this interview, not with the Times or some other publication, with the Post. And then when the Post misrepresents her and misquotes her, as the EEOC determination found, they force her to resign.
Yeah, they set her up.
So, Alan, so she was forced to resign at that point, as you said, and then you filed this EEOC complaint, and you essentially won. They had some harsh words, I think, for the DOE in that decision. Is that right?
Well, they have a particularly ironic line. I don't have it in front of me, but in effect said that the DOE had succumbed to the kind of community prejudice that the creation of Khalil Gibran was intended to dispel. What's unusual is not only does the EEOC not typically uphold claims of employment discrimination. But this particular claim was based on community prejudice. I mean, so that it's not a just a claim of individual discrimination against Debbie Almentosser, but it's a claim that's based on the fact that she was attacked by a bigoted community based on being an Arab and a Muslim, and a government agency, to its great shame, capitulated to that prejudice. Mona, who's in that community, works in that community, can speak to it better than I can. But that's what is significant and unusual about this decision.
Mona, when Alan mentions and the EEOC mentions community, of course, that's one community, and of course, there's other communities out there as well, the Arab community, et cetera. So I'm interested in how you look at this community issue.
What the Department of Education has done and has been doing for the past over 2 years to the school is absolutely outrageous. And it's been very difficult for me, and I'm sure for others, to sit and watch the department discriminate against a woman because of her ethnicity and race, because she's Arab and Muslim, and also against the whole school. Under-resourcing the school at first and then providing the school with inadequate leadership for the school to succeed. I have a question for you two, since you're both lawyers here. Does it look bad if the Department of Education denies the EEOC's claims that they discriminated and then days later remove the principal that they supposedly and definitely now hired unfairly and replace her with an Arab principal?
Well, I'm interested in, Alan, of course, represents Debbie, but I can only tell you from outside, the way I just, you know, I looked at the papers yesterday and today, for me, it just looks completely ridiculous. It looks like they don't, I mean, they're trying, they're, it looks like they're totally scrambling to try and, you know, if and when, and we haven't heard from Alan, whether he's going to be able to settle this or file a case or what in federal court. It looks to me crazy, because here they've now finally put in apparently an Arab principal. The person who's head of the was the principal before just, you know, abruptly resigns or has moved to another school, and now it looks like they're scrambling because they got a bad decision at the EEOC. So if I were a federal judge, we never know what happens, almost laugh him out of court. I'm not Debbie's lawyer, and I don't know what Alan feels like saying on this.
Well,
not firing the.
I think
movement.
I think two things. One, the timing coming after the EEOC decision, a couple of days after, where they're charged with discriminating against an Arab American, so they install an Arab American principal, certainly seems rather suspicious. Proving, you know, what was in their head and were they really that cynical about it is something else. But it's a sequence of events that they'll have to explain away. The other, and is this, I mean, certainly the DOE could have anticipated a strong reaction from the Arab American community once the EEOC decision was announced. And the question is, what impact on the Arab community will this appointment have? That is, the appointment of an Arab American principal in, say, blunting the EEOC determination in Debbie's case.
Well, yeah, I think that you can't just replace one Arab with another. It's not, oh, we fired her, but we hired another Arab.
You're not fungible in legal language.
Right. So, I mean, the fact that they did it is outrageous. The fact that they think they can get away with it is even more outrageous, I think. But it's consistent with the Department of Education's behavior over the years and, you know, very much so this year. It reminds me of when the DOE forced Debbie to resign and then told the press that she would not be considered for the position and then swore before a judge and before the EEOC that she was considered unfairly, right? That sort of sloppy behavior makes me think that they can get away with anything when it comes to certain communities. In fact, the DOE has closed just over the past few months, I believe, over 30 schools in underserved communities, with no regard to parents, no regard to community members, no regard for what's good for the students. And they're consistently replacing these schools with charter schools that only accept certain students. So what are they going to do next?
It does seem to me, in terms of your question, Alan, and Mona's thoughts about it, had they put an Arab principal in immediately after Debbie resigned, then they would have at least, I mean, they could make some kind of argument.
Exactly right. And The fact is there were two Arab American candidates at the time who were mentioned in the EEOC determination. Neither of them was considered. One of them was this man.
Pretty interesting.
That's a very interesting fact. If he's suitable now, why wasn't he suitable then? The obvious answer is the appointment of a replacement for Debbie, a permanent replacement, was only a couple of months after the first explosion of publicity. And the last thing in the world they wanted to do was to reignite community antagonism by appointing another Arab American. So no way in the world were they going to do it. So what they did was they appointed this woman, Holly Reichert. Her central qualification for the position was that she spoke Arabic. During her tenure, the school functioned okay, I guess. I don't know the details, but she's leaving the school not to become principal of another school, but to become a teaching coach, which implies that the DOE really doesn't consider her qualified now to be a principal, and the likelihood was that she wasn't back at the time.
What is the weight of the EEOC decision with respect to a possible court case and its outcome? How can you use that in support of the Arab and Muslim community?
Well, first of all, the DOE investigation is accessible to us, so that eventually what people said to the DOE in the course of their investigation will be part of the record in this case. The determination itself, it's not clear whether that constitutes evidence. On the other hand, in the real world, judges know such things. In the real world, it has to have an impact. I mean, the EEOC is the premier agency in the country for evaluating employment discrimination claims. If they don't have an axe to grind, if they come to the conclusion that she's been the victim of discrimination, surely judges who are aware of that take note.
Now, I used to do some of this work, and at some point they issue a probable cause letter, is that right?
They'll issue a right to sue letter.
Right, right to sue.
This determination is what we used to call a probable cause letter.
Okay.
So it's a determination based on findings. They say in here, we have found. It's not that there's probable cause to believe. They say we have found. Exactly how those findings get used at this point, I'm not certain, except, as I said, that their investigation will be available to us.
Now, where is Debbie now?
Debbie is the coordinator of special education in a Brooklyn high school. She was removed from her principal's position, of course. She then had the equivalent, what's called a principal's assigned position at DOE headquarters, and then they terminated that position. She reverted to tenure on a teacher's line, and she is therefore suffered some compensatory losses, and she is serving in a Brooklyn high school.
Mona, what was the reaction to the Arab community and, of course, your organization when you heard about this decision at EEOC?
Well, I mean, my personal first reaction was shock. And then that night at about 3:30 a.m., I found myself laughing out loud in my bed at the stupidity of the Department of Education, that they would deny these claims that they discriminated again, and then within days replace the principal who they hired unfairly with an Arab. I think the Department of Education is launching an intifada against itself. I think that's what it comes down to right now. Shaking off the old garb of traditional education, replacing it with, the Department of Regurgitation, basically. They consistently regurgitate everything that they start with, from hiring Debbie, hiring Holly Reichert. They deny it, and then they fix it. Why would you fix something that you deny? And also, just constantly, consistently closing schools, disregarding communities. What are they going to do next? Find a bunch of kids with, low test scores and then take away their school? And then replace that school with another school that doesn't accept kids with low test scores and special needs and ELL needs?
Mona, when you look at the forces that were in play here in both the supporters of Debbie, which is the Arab and Muslim community, but it's much wider because she got a lot of support from progressive Jewish community as well.
And even from some non-progressive. Marty Markowitz, I think, supported Debbie in the school, as I recall, the Brooklyn Borough president.
What were the forces that were in contention here, and what do you think motivates them?
The forces that were unhappy with Debbie were first unhappy with the school. The attack against the school started about 6 months before the T-shirt incident began, and that was with the announcement of the school long before the school opened. And then, of course, Debbie was forced to resign before the school opened as well. But these forces are basically against anything different. Not only are they against Arabs and Muslims, but they are, you know, many of them against women, many of them against all people of color. Some of them actually have some really strong white supremacist language that they use. Xenophobic, I think, is the term to describe them.
You know, the irony is that a school was supposed to set up to advance and promote and teach respect for the accomplishments of Arab culture over the years. These people are against that. So what are they against? You know, promoting the knowledge of the Greeks and the Romans into the Middle Ages, denouncing the invention of algebra? I mean, where are these people coming from?
No, Alan pointed that out in the EEOC decision. They said, basically said, it's pretty ironic that this is happening. Alan, I'm interested in what you're thinking about for your next steps to the extent you can talk about it.
First of all, there is, as you may know, a separate lawsuit in federal court based on her First Amendment claim. That's pending before the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. Was argued about a month or so ago. Probably won't have a decision for another couple of months. The EEOC claim based on Title VII, employment discrimination, is an entirely separate action. So the EEOC has written a letter with its determination to the DOE asking them to respond by next Wednesday, the 24th, to see whether or not they are willing to work towards what they call a just resolution of the plaintiff's claims or the charging party's claims. So I would assume sometime by the 24th I'll hear something from them. I'm not at all confident that we're going to be able to reach a just resolution, but we're certainly open to those discussions. Failing a resolution, we will get from the EEOC a right to sue letter, and we'll have 90 days to bring suit. We will also talk to the Department of Justice to try and convince them to join such a lawsuit. They have the authority to do that. This is an important case, both legally and practically for the Arab American community. It's highly visible. I would hope to make contact with high-level people within the DOJ to try and convince them that they should join this lawsuit.
And Mona, did you have any last thoughts you want to share with us?
I think it's especially important now, leading up to the 24th, that we, as community members from all communities, contact the Department of Education and the mayor and tell them to fix it. Put Debbie in the position, in her rightful position as interim acting principal of the school, and not just any Arab, as if they're interchangeable.
Is there any website that you folks have that our listeners could tune in on?
If you Google CIS Qadjiyya, Communities in Support of Qadjiyya, you'll get right to the website.
Congratulations. I think this was an historic victory in this city. Michael said, when we both read this, I was so excited about it. Thank you, Alan.
Thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much, Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.